welcome again to Back to the Future, the Zoomcast and podcast that puts those once and future predictions we've been making, or in the case of my next guest, have been party to making, under the spotlight. My name is Martin Raymond, and this week I'm joined by Ryan Lange. Ryan, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad I could make time in my lockdown schedule.
I'm so impressed. I've been watching you and following you. I feel a bit like a stalker, actually. You know, you have been everywhere. And I just wanted to kind of give people a glimpse of, well, what you do. If you think about it, normally I'm interviewing people who are talking about innovators and early adopters. And actually, I kind of thought, well, hang on, Ryan is one of them. You're a cultural curator, a navigator, explorer, and founder of Hungama. Okay, I hope I got that word wrong. Once described as a fantabuloso Studio 54 style extravaganza for South Asian LGBTQIA. Do you see how I said that? My dyslexia, unfortunately, makes it difficult. But did I get that right? And did I get the name of the club right, more importantly?
Absolutely. Like 10 points to Martin. Hungama is Urdu and Hindi for the word chaos and bedlam. And the alphabet soup is getting bigger, but you did it well.
There you are. So I'm kind of, I guess I'm doing it justice by saying, well, I did say it was Studio 54, but it's kind of more than that, because really, to me, it always reminded me of one of those living art moments, I guess, in the best way Studio 54 was, where you showed how different people could be. So not just in terms of their gender or in terms of how they express themselves, but I'm going to quote somebody here. They said, it's a hope of how things could be if we got the future right. Now, what do you think of that?
That hearing that from you is actually really humbling. I highly regard Future Laboratory as well as yourself. And when I started Hungama, it was a reaction to the fact that my needs in the queer community were not being met, and my connection to myself the synapse was not there. And so when I took some time to distill my feelings, I realized that I was missing Bollywood culture, and I was firmly planted in fashion and art, and I felt like that injection was necessary and needed. And at that point, 3 years ago, there weren't any queer public-facing South Asians that were eccentric and audacious and out there like the nuances of Studio 54. And Andy Warhol really inspires my work. Studio 54 really inspires my culture. And I was like, why don't we just see what happens? And after only a year, we started seeing a sprinkle of South Asians in our white-centric queer spaces. And now we have like 300 or 400 South Asians who are queer accepting. They're engaged, they're actors, they're singers, they're models, they're set designers, they're poets and writers, and they're all there. And Hungama has been that beacon or that sort of twilight bark that has called them all in. So I'm deeply, deeply proud.
So it kind of, if you think about it, because the word, I think it's either Hindi or Urdu to describe, you're saying chaos, confusion, riot, uproar. They're kind of words that you associate with violent change, one, but also, I think more importantly, with creativity and with transformation. Are these kind of words that you would apply to yourself in terms of how you kind of created this thing out of chaos, almost out of nothing, really?
Absolutely. Like, I was described before Hungama as a South Asian unicorn. And people would say to me that, like, if you didn't exist, people would think you were made up. And it's because I was at London Fashion Week, not being able to place myself as a designer, a stylist, or even a fashion photographer. I was at an art gallery curating guerrilla exhibitions about fashion. I was in East London as a South Asian, and no one knew where I was from because of my name being Ryan, which is white presenting, my accent being Canadian, which is American. I felt so displaced. And so I just firmly said, listen, amidst all this chaos, I'm going to create a fort for myself and people can come to me and see what I'm about. And that's, I guess, where the impetus came from. And I think Hungama, when said in Hindi or Urdu, it is said with a sense of pride. It's a sense of opulence and celebration and chaos, and like it's so wonderful to take words in English and highlight the more positive meanings and the more celebratory meanings within the word, because it is an experience. Those who aren't under the South Asian umbrella come to the event and they're like, it was incredible, because when we were there we felt included. It was welcoming. It was an energy. It was a vibration. And that's why I like to describe it as Hangama.
I mean, it was interesting just, you know, thinking about both, I guess, the club and also the sensibility and the aesthetic and the philosophy that sat behind it. You know, these are things that you associate with, I guess, in some ways, forces of nature and of change. So did you, when you set up, were you seeing it as something that would cause so much change, or as somebody said to me, Martin, you know, really, it was just great fun to be there. All of that other, what I call the backcasting that I applied to it, you know, they said that came later, but first of all, it was about fun. Or was it really about something you were kind of considering about, you know, how queer history could be changed and the way it could move differently, for example, into the future?
Well, I think because we're having a frank conversation, I think it would be very naive of me to not acknowledge my curatorial strategies and tactics I put into place. I felt that we needed, as the South Asian community, to stop complaining behind closed doors and stop feeling sorry for ourselves. I felt like I realized that enough of us creative vanguards were all sitting around saying we weren't allowed to, we had run away. And I was like, well, we're all here. And like, our parents aren't like in control of us anymore. We don't need to ask for permission. So let's just have a massive order of the fuck it's and just do it. And and so when I did the first party, a lot of people were very excited to hear the music, amazed and gassed that it was occurring in the Glory in Haggerston. It was a pub that had turned into this like Indian temple situation. It was very experiential. I had marigold and decorations designed by Max Allen, who's an incredible art director and designer. And then we had music from that was just a complete fusion of hip hop, R&B, Bollywood, and almost East London and London inspired R&B and Bollywood. And then the second time I threw it, or third time, I basically decided that I wanted to up the ante of craziness. So at that time, I realized that Hangama was actually a physical manifestation and a physical club night of who I was. And at that point, I was hanging out with a lot of Polish club kids who I called the witches. And so I hired them to be hosts for the party. And a lot of people were like, why have you hired all these Polish queer Lee Bowery-esque characters to come in and dance and be crazy? And they're not South Asian. And I was like, they aren't South Asian, you're right. But they've gone through the same oppression, if not more than we have. And they are here in gargantuan Victorian dresses, crazy makeup. They're setting the bar for how crazy we can be. And after that party, taking that techno club scene and just mashing it dichotomously with the Bollywood sound that I created, it sort of ignited a possibility that has only grown in leaps and bounds since we've thrown the party. So it was basically me putting a lot of spice in a dish and knowing that everyone would react to it.
Well, I think you say that reacting, but also quite the way you use the word, you know, you're setting the bar for people. You know, you're kind of in some ways imagining what could be and using people that maybe sit outside that framework to imagine what this life could be for other people. And I think in some ways that's, I guess, what good futurism is about. You know, if I think about, you know, being Irish, for example, gay, vegetarian, and atheist, you know, having problems with dyslexia. And I always think, you know, that kind of makes you want to make the future different. And what I quite liked about not just the club, but also a lot of the other work you were doing, behind it sat a desire to make things different. You know, the pathway you had, the pathway which was being laid out by the opportunity, and then suddenly the way you shaped it or kind of created an arc that took you to a different place. Is that intentional, or is that something you kind of learn and think about as you're doing it?
I don't think it's intentional. I think it is more intuitive. I don't know how to physically paint with these physical things like the club space and the club kids and myself. I didn't even know how to DJ. I basically just got in and I just used every single ability that I had. And if I didn't, I found people who could help me. And I think by bringing in people from different walks of lives and creating that sort of mosaic of talent and the mosaic of color and texture and possibility, like you come up with something that you just really can't deny its greatness. It's exciting. And it's everything that Our Night did was a reaction to things that we didn't like about the current state of club culture or queer culture. And so our party, I think the reason, one of the major strengths behind it was the fact that we were inundated with amazing nights that existed, but those were nights where there was a clear VIP era. There were clear people who could get in and couldn't get in. There was a clear color preference or body shape preference or sound preference. And Hangama was like the area that you could go to hear everything, because no sound is the same at that party, but it was for everyone. You could show up in a t-shirt and sneakers and feel like a social reject, or you could come dressed as an opulent Hindu deity, and both of you mattered.
So I'd still get in, I think, if I came just dressed in my normal sneakers and old shirt and baggy trousers. There's still hope for me.
I didn't want to put too fine a point on your outfit, but yes, of course, you're allowed to.
I think so. What I liked about and your work, because I remember, you know, meeting you the first time and thinking, actually, it's about how you seize opportunity when it doesn't seem to be apparently there. And I always think, you know, when you're thinking about the future hasn't happened. It, you know, it hasn't, doesn't exist. And yet, as futurists, or it, I guess in terms of how you curate things, you almost have to make it happen. But in the making of it, and I think this is the point I always try to get over to people, in the making of it, you can make it different and reshape it in a way that accommodates those oddities, those freaks, those queers, all of those people that don't have a voice or a position in kind of heteronormative places. And I just kind of wonder about that moving forward. Do you still think culturally that we are allowing for that, or are we now trying to fit people into neat boxes and trying to get them to fit into a future that kind of suits the many but is increasingly not working for the few? Or is that just me being a bit pessimistic about what could be?
I don't think it's pessimism at all. I think it's a reality. I think queer culture is forever at war with the boxes. Like, I think queer culture at its most powerful and potent is going to be an eradication of any box. I have a dream that we can be in a room where you don't need to ask someone's gender, but they will tell you their gender, and that is okay. And you don't need to understand someone for what they are presenting versus what they don't seem to be, but you are in a safe space knowing that they are who they are, and that expression is fantastic. I think we're at an interesting point now where social media and access to information has changed commercial culture so vastly. Like, at any given point, something can go viral, or something can be misinterpreted or miscontextualized, and or something can be put on a platform that reaches a huge demographic. And it's important for it to be understood and not chastised or trolled. And so that is the journey of futurism for me. It's like, how do we start teaching people that any shape, color, or texture of person is allowed? And by doing that, we've actually opened up infinite possibilities, rather than trying to have a finite amount of things you are allowed to color with.
It's funny, you were beginning to sound like Stephen Hawking then. I wasn't quite sure if it was the mic or it's just you were channeling, you know, that man who really understood the kind of possibilities we live into. And it kind of, I guess, takes me to one of the points that a lot of people have raised recently about, you know, the future and how it could be. And this is a whole debate around culture wars. So that kind of phrase that has cropped up, the American elections, you know, here in the UK, Europe particularly, where we're talking about, you know, everything from no platforming, cancelling out, you know, decolonization. I hear the Daily Mail jumping into my head there, but also, you know, by me, gay, trans, non-binary, etc. And I guess what is the real question here is, this simply, you know, people pushing back against the inevitability of change, or is it people like you, for example, myself, a lot of others, trying to make the future not just better, because I wasn't never sure the better is always good, but trying to make it different and remind people that these differences are just in some ways normal. That's how the world is, if we really whipped off the top and had a good look inside, or is that me being Irish again and being a bit sort of optimistic in this case?
No, I just think that culture wars and this sort of rat race for power is fueled by fear, and it's fueled by toxic masculinity. I think that if we were to all sit together and ask what the world would look like if we divided the power and divided the creativity and divided the opportunity equally, that that we would all not be at a loss. It's like there's only something to gain if we all share the pie. And I think so when people are not allowing and trying to cancel, I think it's just social strategy in order to like just level yourself up against or ahead of someone. And like, because realistically, I think what we haven't done right now is galvanized or given accurate tools to the allies to support more marginalized communities. And so like my work now is, as beautiful it was to celebrate Bollywood and create a platform for South Asians, my work is like, how do we take anyone who knows about my night and about my work and give them the tools that they need in their everyday life to fight for the people who need to be sitting beside them? And it's not an activist positioning. It is a situation where you involuntarily, like breathing, are looking out for people because you know that they'll look out for you, and that can only build a better world.
Yeah, it's interesting. Somebody said to me recently, if you put two people down to speak and you put them on opposite sides of a table, they will argue. If you put them side by side, walking towards the same horizon, they will agree and discuss and have more beneficial and beautiful conversations. And I always think that's really what, you know, I guess you're trying to do, but a lot of people, when they talk about, you know, making the world fairer, it's that everybody can walk in the same direction and everybody can see the same horizon and maybe look to the same opportunities. And I kind of feel that a lot of the work you're now embarking on is taking you towards that. But I wanted to give you just two words. You talk about, for example, yourself as a curator. And I understand how curating work, it's kind of housing, it's fermenting, it's thinking. And then you have the sense of being an archivist. So these are, you know, where you're perhaps accommodating and documenting things that may not always be visible, but also need to be preserved with a view, or is this correct, with a view of helping us not just understand the past, but to be better equipped for the future. And I kind of feel that's, as a forecaster, that's how I would see it. But is that how you see those roles that you do versus how they will help you negotiate the kind of things you're going to face tomorrow?
Absolutely. I think it's really wonderful to hear you articulate it like that, because as a curator, my first exhibition I curated, I was 23 years old. I was asked by an art gallery to put on a show that would get a lot of attention and put on a show in the month of September. And me being the sort of lateral thinker and creative person I was, I decided to showcase nail art, so fingernail art, as a form of fashion design, and put it in a gallery context and get all of these nail technicians and exhibit their works as works of contemporary sculpture. Because effectively the nail bed is a canvas and nail polish is a paint. And so I put together this show, which is turning 10 years old Nailphilia.
Oh my god, sorry, yes, you got, I didn't realize that. Go.
Yeah, so I did that show without Instagram. I did that show with just Twitter and a lot of tenacity. And now it's the first nail art exhibition of its time, and it's shaped nail careers. It's changed the beauty industry, and it's given nail technicians the confidence to be some of the biggest and most respected creatives in their field. And I mean, like, it was after that show that Lady Gaga went mental with nails, and Beyonce and Jessie J went mental with nails. And it was because of the power of bringing everyone together and seeing the beauty in something. And I think, go ahead.
Yeah, no, sorry for, I think as well, it excited me when I saw it, because it was capturing what I was seeing on the street, walking around, in conversations, people chatting about it. And then I had this, you would probably find this amusing, where someone says, oh yes, well, we've reached, you know, peak nail, at the moment. I think, well, isn't it interesting that there was a point where there was no nails, and then suddenly we're in this peak nail moment. This is like 4 years ago that term was used. And I thought, again, you had identified those cultural anomalies that were coming in, and those strange things that were going against the tide. Because everything, if you remember, was about gloss and shine and neatness. And we had that period of somebody said it was like the preppy pressed down, where everything was so controlled and modulated. And then this explosion of color and righteous pleasure and joy, and that was just somebody's nails. And I go, wow. So you did that, and you kind of identified it. At the time, were you consciously thinking about the zeitgeist, or were you simply celebrating a bit of culture that you felt was being overlooked or neglected? What was the thoughts behind it?
It was definitely the latter. It was me seeing an intersection point between fashion, art, and beauty, and showcasing it in a way that could only be captivating. And so I was really proud of it, because I agree with you. At that point, when I was looking at what could possibly be seen, everything was in the gaze of gnomecore. It was quite normal. We were like at this point where everyone was like trying to go with neutral palettes and be really chic and glossy and like, yeah. But then you had this underbelly of like pop culture that was just very abstract and avant-garde, with like the Katy Perry's and the Nicki Minaj's and the Lady Gaga's. And I was like, where is this access point? Where can the craziness that they exhibit in music videos and on stage access the fan and access the fashionista? And that's when I noticed that nails were the only place where on your body, where with creativity and not money, could you access the fashion houses, the pop stars, and your everyday life? And so
was there a defiance? I'm thinking about the whole, you know, tattooing. I'm thinking about how tattoo was covert, so inking was really hidden, and then gradually it was revealed, but only in certain places. And you never do the face, and you didn't do beyond the wrists, and you had this whole kind of etiquette. And yet with nails, it was one of the few things you couldn't really hide, unless they were acrylic or synthetic, and you were putting them on when you go. But generally, they were there, and I always felt there was a certain quiet act of defiance. I remember seeing somebody being stopped by the police, and they had asked her to over. This is how I got to see her. And she had the longest, most beautiful nails ever. They were almost like spoons in length. So what the police were trying to say to her, well, obviously you couldn't be driving because your nails must be getting in the way. And she said, well, no, it's called driving with your palms on the steering wheel. She said, it's not a racing car. It's a little electric zipper belt. And I quite like this idea that she was reminding people that it was okay to celebrate and be different, but actually it didn't impinge on practicality, if that's what the police were trying to accuse her of.
Well, I think this is really interesting conversation, because what this shows is the lack of representation in media and the lack of representation in industries. Because when I curated Nailphilia, people were like, oh, we didn't expect it to be that successful. But that was the birth of Instagram. And who was on Instagram of the millions of followers? There were unrepresented Black people of color and ethnic minorities who were looking into their phones to find versions of themselves. And while they were doing that, they were at home practicing with nail polish. And these are women and girls who didn't have access to luxury goods, weren't allowed jobs in the centers of metropolitan cities, were working all these small gigs. And the only way that they can feel like they're a part of it is by being creative with their nails. And Nailphilia allowed them a point where they could see themselves becoming a part of that world. And so it for me, that's only looking back now and with what you're saying. What we're doing is we're underestimating the power of numbers that exist with following. And instead of trying to inspire them and take what we have and give it to them, what we're trying to do is get them to idolize us and to care about us and what we're selling them. And so that's a paradigm shift that needs to occur.
So that kind of takes me to an idea or a question, because a lot of what you're doing is capturing a moment and then broadcasting it. And I was thinking about, a lot of the ideas you have are sometimes, like as with Nailphilia, for example, it was slightly ahead of its time, because although it was happening here and one part of the culture, it wasn't visible to everybody else. And that's, to me, how the future works. It's not that you're inventing it or that you are, predicting it. You're simply saying it's happening here, like where the innovator sits and the early adopter. And then gradually we will all be part of this new cultural shift. Now, actually, I spoke to an artist called Ainub Jain, who simply creates artifacts from the future. And she has a thing called a time cannon, which fires the artifact back to our time. And it kind of sits in your table or in the gallery in the museum. And you think, well, what is it? And she was saying, well, actually, the job for you to do is to diagnose from the signs that sit within it as to what this thing could be. And I kind of felt some of the things you do, when I see them, I think, oh, what's he doing? And then gradually it occurs to me. So I'm just wondering, have you ever thought about, having a time cannon? And if you did, what you would fire back in it for us to go, wow, right, what are you up to now? What's going on?
The funny thing is that that's kind of how I think. Lockdown has really allowed me to look at how my mind works. And I've had a lot of wonderful friends recently watch me and then sort of reflect back some of my thought processes. And what I do in order to create the future for myself is I astro project in a way. So like whenever I spend time on my own, I take myself to 2030 or 2040 and I find out what age I'm at and I ask myself where I am and I ask myself what the world is like and I ask myself what is the work that I've accomplished and what am I proud of? And I just start piecing together this reverse mathematical equation. And by the time I end up back to myself now in present day, I kind of know what my next move is. And I know who I need to get on my side. And I know where I feel like the world is going to be leaning towards or growing. Like, and I just kind of, I feel like I get insight.
Yeah, that's kind of, if you think about it, that's how classic scenario planners work. You know, they hypothesize about the future, they create it, and then they sort of work back from it in one case, which they call backcasting, the new term there for everybody, or it's where they create the scenarios you're doing, then you kind of work towards it. And I kind of think generally a lot of us do this. We call it daydreaming or, you know, mind wandering or something fantasizing. But I think it's always negated by the fact that it's not seen to be important or seen to be a powerful part of how we should run our lives. It's always seen to be something you do when you're doing nothing. And yet, I guess from your point of view and certainly from mine, these are the core things you do to make not just yourself happen and be better and different and I guess think greater, but also in some ways you're putting stepping stones out for other people to follow and to perhaps use them when they don't have the opportunity to do this for themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah, I guess in a way every project I've worked on, exhibition or event, is a time capsule of what I predicted into the future. And it's an artifact of my quest to get there. I think one of the main arteries of my work is that like, I don't want to do it alone. I think my skill set and my talent, I guess zone of genius, if you will, is facilitation. And so I find people who can do things incredibly well, and I bring them in and get them to do it to only help their dreams and their trajectory. I was fortunate enough in my early 20s to have a lovely drink with the jewelry designer, Sean Lean, who is Alexander McQueen's jewelry designer when he was designing his original collections at the for London Fashion Week. And Sean, I think after a couple of gin and tonics, I don't think he'll mind me saying this, but he told me that—
No, I think he has many gin and tonics now if you wish.
I think it was a wonderful moment where he told me how Lee would tell Katie, his stylist, a certain angle and direction to go through, and tell Sean a certain direction to go through, and then tell his team a certain direction to go through, and everyone wouldn't be allowed to speak to each other. They would be kind of left in the dark, and they wouldn't know what was going on, and they were frustrated because they didn't know what anyone else was doing, and they felt like they were in a vacuum, but they were creating. And it was only when the models were being dressed and everything was coming together that people saw the full vision. And that really resonated with me when I heard that story, because I feel similar in the sense that like I will throw a hangama or put on an exhibition and I'll be asking someone to make, I don't know, a 30-foot like sculpture made out of nail varnish, or I'll be asking a performer to be performing a certain way, or a DJ set to like encompass a different genre. And they're like, what are you doing? Why are we doing this? Like, just leave it with me. And it's sort of like creating these mashups, or these, I guess, moments of hangama that really allow me to create new versions of culture that people didn't expect.
I guess, you know, if you think about that, in some ways, it's the you know, the counterintuitive way to work art, because art has always been about the singular voice, the what I call the muscular vision, where everything's by one person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, while yes, art historically have great workshops, you never knew who was in that workshop. You didn't know who painted the hand or the head or the ear, you know, it was them. And I think now there's a great push towards collaboration and allowing people to participate in the vision. But I quite like the way you're still allowing for the fact that you see what's happening, and maybe it's not so clear to other people. I think it's that, you know, the classic story where the wise men describe and wise women describe, you know, the leg in a particular way. They describe an ear, they describe this strange long tail that wasn't like a tail. And you realize they're describing an elephant, but they neither have the language to describe the full thing. That sits somewhere else. And I think I quite like the idea that, you know, in some ways the future can be a bit like that. There are clues to it and fragments sitting around. And sometimes we need to step back or have a storyteller. Because I think one of the things that occurred to me about a lot of the work you do, you tell good stories. And I think with the future, with art, with culture generally, the best things succeed when there is a great narrative that we can apply to them, or a great narrative that we can follow when we're actually thinking about, you know, the end journey we need to get to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's interesting of what you said is that we are only as powerful as our parts when put together. Like, I think in society and looking forward into the future, like, we should be looking at other communities that we do not understand and we do not associate with our daily lives. And we should ask them to describe a certain part of the world. I think like the trans community, the Black community, the South Asian queer community, they should all be invited in and they should be asked like, how can we change the way we operate in order to build a better future? Because then we'll all end up with something we never expected, but we'll all be proud of it because of our contribution.
To do it. See, I think that always requires bravery. And one of the things, I read a quote, actually was watching a video you did on YouTube when you were talking about curating. And one of the things that struck me, because I thought actually this is quite a powerful, you probably can't remember saying it, but I'm going to try to quote to you as you said. You said, we should never allow ourselves to exist in fear. Ours has to be about challenging doubts and about not worrying about those what ifs. So I really thought, wow, okay. That was in East London. You were at, I think, an event in the Truman Brewery. So that was quite profound because it was in the afternoon. But it really struck me as a great piece of advice. And I really wanted you to reflect on, are there things now that you still, may not fear, but you still have that doubt pop into your head before you actually go ahead and do it? Because I know you're going to do it anyway. But what are the things that you still have kind of, you know, little doubts about, or even, you know, big worries that maybe I just can't do this?
From a young age, I've always been a bit of a renegade. And I've always reminded myself that it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. And so that's how I started in East London 10 years ago when I was doing guerrilla exhibitions, making guerrilla fashion films, like helping the people that I was inspired by get where they want to go and curating along the way. I think now with the blessings and the privilege of being able to put on shows and having people like my work and want to know what I'm doing, I have a different kind of fear. And my fear is like, what if no one cares? Or what if I get it wrong? Or what if I make a mistake? And because 10 years ago, we weren't in a place where inclusivity was championed and cancel culture was so like intense. And like back then you could make an honest mistake and no one would clock it. And now if I looked back and I would rephrase all my exhibitions and I would have maybe done a completely different group of artists, or I would have maybe injected a whole different morale behind some of the things that I did. And maybe I wouldn't even curated some of the shows that I curated or allowed myself to partner with certain brands. Right. But I think only thing I can do now is not worry and ruminate on getting it wrong. I can only build in an infrastructure for what I'm going to do if I do get it wrong, but keep going anyways.
Right, really interesting. Because I was thinking about, you know, Damien Barr, the author, where he had challenged, I think it was a member of the Booker Prize, about her views on trans. And then I guess a journalist, because journalists are forever doing this, they went back into his Instagram posts and found that there were some rather kind of nasty comments about trans people. And you know, his defense was about, well, you know, we all make mistakes. And I thought, well, actually, there's also, as you say, an element of forgiveness, because while he wasn't willing to forgive the person, he wanted to be forgiven himself. And I just wonder, is with you know, the way we need to shape our futures is, because somebody said it would be great if nice was part of a new future. That would be a nice thing to have. Forgiveness might help, because then, to your point, if we make mistakes, which we do inevitably and all the time, that I know I can make them with a view for learning rather than a view of being cancelled out completely. Or is that, again, just people weaseling away from the fact that we have to really think about our decisions as we move forward into what essentially seems to be becoming a more uncertain and somebody said dislocated world ahead of us?
I don't think we'll ever be able to create a space for ourselves to not make mistakes. I think we will never be able to confidently be like, okay, yeah, no, I'm in the clear. My Twitter is fine. My blogs are fine. My Instagram is fine. Like the world will change in a way where something you've done will hit a tripwire. And I think what you need to practice is knowing that, like, you have a team of people around you and you have done the work yourself to understand and be open and not defensive. I think the reason why I'm quite passionate about this is because I've watched some of the most incredible, talented and visionary people who could only be described as people from another planet, like John Galliano, Alexander McQueen, like some of these people who were just placed and then observed and then watched as they fell from these ivory towers. And those are the preliminary, I guess, carcasses in terms of careers that sort of outline this cancel culture and outline this, like, these people are bad. And I was like, no one is bad. They were just put in situations where they were misunderstood and trying their best to be artistic and trying their best to be creative, where their own trauma and their own problems have amplified in times where they are just trying to rest their minds and they're just trying to make sense of what's happening. So, like, I think mental health and understanding of people's places in life, their privileges in lives, their healing journey are super, super important for me to make space for now. Like, I think you starting this podcast saying that I'm Irish and I'm dyslexic. Like, 10 years ago, no one would care about those two things, but now they have gravitas.
Yeah, and obviously the I think it's more about, I think at the moment we carry tags with her name, and when I use it, I use it, I guess, in some ways slightly facetiously, because I always think the notion that we have all of these things that sit within us and are part of us. And in some ways we don't articulate them, we show them. Like, reading that LGBTQI for me is difficult, because I remember my first piece of radio, which I didn't radio for years afterwards, it was the Space Shuttle Columbia has departed from Cape Canaveral. And to me, when I read it, it came out, the Space Shuttle Columbo has left Cape Canaveral. And so that's what I'd read on the page. And I realized that these things, you know, either we accept them or hide them, which I think is what we've done, or we now celebrate and remind people that these things, you know, are perhaps a good way to create foundations for tomorrow, which I think brings me to a quote. Famously, I think it was Peter Drucker, who's a business guru, those terrible people that annoy us until we become one ourselves. And he said, you know, the best way to predict tomorrow is to create it. And I wanted to ask you, I'm not going to ask you to create Rhineland, because that might be a bit annoying given what happened to a lot of gay people like ourselves during the Second World War, but maybe I'm going to call it Langeville get you to kind of fantasize about what this future geodesic dome could look like, or rather what sits within it that I'd like you to encounter if I kind of travel into the future and stumble upon it one day behind the trees. What am I going to find there?
It's really funny, because my new project and initiative is actually a response to this type of question. And so I recently was in a restaurant, and someone asked me how I was, and my immediate reply was, I'm not dead yet. And they were like, that was an interesting reply. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm not. And then I had this moment where I realized that my people, like the South Asian community, has survived a lot. The South Asian queer community is constantly on a struggle to survive. The queer community has survived the AIDS pandemic. And now we as the world are surviving this corona pandemic. And I was like, what is the future going to look like? And like, how am I going to contribute to that? And so I've started this new initiative called NDY, which it's duality is to me is that it stands for not dead yet, but also it's a new day yesterday. But the impetus behind it is just, it's starting to look as how do we create this world that we can all live in? And I subverted that by saying, how do we look inside and start nourishing ourselves to create a utopia that we're happy in? And so I'm providing free mental health and physical fitness classes for the queer community, LGBTQIA+, including the allies. So straight people are invited, and so are anyone else who's queer identifying. And I'm starting to build a new wellness hub where it is POC, non-binary and trans forward facing. It is radically inclusive and it's free for people to take, because I think while we're in lockdown, we need to start addressing our inner demons and our inner saboteurs and our blockages. And so that would be my answer, is that I think Ryanland or Langeville, I really hope is a chemical synapse that I can create inside people. So if nailphilia was a beautiful accessory that was on someone's fingertips and hungama was a beautiful moment in a nightclub, I'm trying to see how I can create that inside someone. But for them to do that, I need them to have the bravery and the courage to allow me in.
Is this going to be a physical space or will it be virtual? Or are you seeing it kind of blended as we move forward out of lockdown? Or is it hypothetical? Maybe I'm jumping ahead because I can see this working, but I could see it as a kind of a blended utopia of fantastic colors and great, well-being, bliss. I think bliss. I want to have the word bliss on top of the dome. I think bliss would be quite good.
Well, the website is launching shortly, and it's going to be a subscription service for anyone in the queer community or anyone interested to see slow news and deep dive think pieces that are going to be curated by thought leaders in our community. And so it'll be accessible, and it won't be like a regular platform. You go in to learn and to realize that what you read affects your brain. It creates dopamine, serotonin, or oxytocin. And then the classes are available currently because of lockdown online. So every day we have classes that span from introduction to weights with British Sign Language, or a gong bath every Monday night by a non-binary person. We have pranayama and meditation on the weekend to keep people balanced, especially if they feel off. And then what we're doing is creating a fitness community that is completely different to the more white-centric six packs and skinny waist aesthetics that we see. And it's more about embracing body shapes and knowing that like health is not indicative of an outer being, it's an internal being. And what the plan is to help keep our culture alive. So as tiers reduce, we're gonna be working with some of East London's queer club nights and allowing them to pop up as immersive classes in gym spaces. So Hangama will hopefully be hosting a yoga class, or we'll have another club night that is infamous for its own reasons in its own community, and we'll have them hosting a spin class or have them hosting a weights class and allow the queer culture to go into fitness that way, and creating a more secret cinema style experience that, you know, is only going to keep.
I'm fascinated because I actually once fell into a gong bath, would you believe?
That must have hurt.
I know the guy who was behind me, as in the next speaker, was about to do this fantastic 30-minute, gong chant exposure, and I fell on top of him. I was coming off stage and tripped and fell in literally onto his gong. So I can say that I've actually fallen into a gong bath. Just the thing that occurred to me is a lot of the things you do, and in fact, I'm just really reminded of it here in our conversation about, the excitement and I guess the vision and the way you just, I think you look optimistically at things. I'm going to jump into it. Where are the times that you did something and it just didn't go right? Because one of the things I always ask people on the podcast is, what were the things that went wrong about your musings about the future, for example? But what did you learn? Because that's really what I'm trying to get to, is what did you particularly learn from something that on surface value might seem like to you personally like a failure, but you go, wow, later when I look back, look where it got me.
Some of the things that I've gleaned and learned about my career is that, like, not everyone's going to get it. You have a lot of people who have your back, but and a lot of people who have your best interests, but sometimes, like, you need to be aware of how it changes as you associate with people. I'm a very codependent person, so I present an idea to a group of people and I'm like, come, let's do this. And then eventually I'm not aware of like what I'm doing and what they're doing in my experience versus their experience, and it starts to merge and it becomes a bit chaotic and sometimes even toxic. So it's really affected me. So I've only recently, and especially through lockdown, managed to build the courage to just do things on my own and realize that there are going to be times where I'm working really well or working really slowly, and having the bravery to just to manifest it by myself rather than having a counterpart. Other things, I've had to battle conversion rights, like as someone who creates physical events and has to have the events be successful and also paid, and like in terms of entrances or tickets, or even selling artwork as an art curator. Like I found that like you really need to have a personal connection with people and have their buy-in. Otherwise you could have an event that has 2,000 or 3,000 attendees and then only 70 show up. And like, I've had a couple of events where I'm like, why did that happen? And what is going on in today's world that is not allowing people to commit to their click? And it's made me realize that sometimes those communities aren't ready, or sometimes you need to communicate a different way, or sometimes you just need to keep failing and then one day it will succeed.
Yeah, I think it is the issue about commitment. And if you're doing what you're doing, which is constantly exposing yourself to, I guess, the gaze of others, that you end up feeling vulnerable because if people respond differently, or if they don't turn up. We run events and we've got 300 people who've said yes to it. And, you know, there's two of us, myself and Danny, who was with us earlier as the producer, having a cup of tea and wondering what's happened. And I think, you know, we see that as a reflection, you know, bad on us, rather than, as you say, looking to what are the bigger concerns and issues that are happening on, you know, the kind of planet around us. And I always get a bit reflective. We have to kind of think about, because I know that people are desperate now to have a cup of tea or equivalent, depending on what time they're listening to this. Some people listen late at night, so I know they're not having tea or having other things. But I always say to guests, if you are now in my position as a forecaster and soothsayer, you know, you're looking ahead, crystal ball gazing, what are the three predictions that you're going to give me about tomorrow? But also you have to give one that is sincere in that you believe it, and two which I have to guess are maybe incorrect. But I'm never quite good at this. I always get it wrong. But I just thought I'd try it out on you, because you obviously have a great reputation for, on one side, you know, quite fantastic views of tomorrow, but then also quite grounded. So what are you going to tell me that I have to guess? Well, which one is going to work? What do you think?
Oh, so is this like two truths and a lie?
yeah, exactly that. So this is the thing, it's like, you know, it's like fortune cookies. You open the fortune cookie, you find three things in, and people go, that's just not going to happen. And then it happens. You know, this is what I thought.
The pandemic is definitely one of them. Everyone was like, this could never happen to us during our lifetime. And here we are. I think one of them would be that, I just don't know, because I'm like super optimistic and most of the things that I've hoped for have come true in my life. Three predictions about tomorrow. Two are sincere and one just made up. Okay, let's see. That
we're on edge. I'm waiting.
Yeah. Oh my god. That the change that we will endure will be painful before it is pleasurable.
Okay. I would say that's true. That will happen. There. Yeah. That's my
Okay. And the other one that I want to say is that we will see, I don't know, we'll see a war in the next 10 years.
You know, oddly, I'm going to have to switch my thing and say that will possibly happen as well. I mean, look what's happening in America. You know, the great fear of civil war again. And Europe, the same thing, where, you know, the far right have got into such a position that views are no longer overlappable. They sit at extremes, and maybe that could happen. So gosh, you're worrying me now, because given your reputation, I'm kind of fearing that you're putting me in a spot. I have one. What about the notion that babies in the future will contain three different types of DNA from three different sources? How does that sound?
I mean, that sounds like a possibility, only because I'm a huge fan of Jurassic Park.
Yeah. No, you're right. It's just been declared. It happened. That's really? What I love about. Yeah, that's why I love doing this. I always look up the weirdest forecasts because all guests come up with, you know, quite good, reasonable ones. Although you've been quite challenging today, I have to say. Yeah. And then I go, okay, here's mine. And people go, wow, that's not going to happen. And generally, I choose something which is not just going to happen and inevitable, but probably has happened over the past week, which is the case. So, Ryan Langic, many thanks for joining us today on Back to the Future. You know, you can find out more about Ryan and his work at, well, surprisingly, it's ryanlangic.com. Hungama, I guess, from lockdown, and also, which we didn't get a chance to talk about, but maybe next time, The Big Flower Fight on Netflix. Just watch out for that dragon. Okay, until next time, keep listening, keep looking, learning, and asking about what's new and what's next. Thank you.